On This Week in Enterprise Tech, IBM bets the farm on big data, and we talk all about IPv6. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 82, recorded March 10th, 2014. Be a good netizen. Adopt IPv6. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace which connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. And by RingCentral. The cloud-based phone system we use just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs and RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. And by TechServe, the world's largest independent Apple retailer and professional services provider. Go to techserve.com/twyatt-7sins to get access to the free ebook on the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I'm joined by an all-star cast, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how is the geek in paradise?
Geek in paradise is fine and dandy and getting ready for Mini Maker Faire here in Honolulu this coming Saturday.
I don't know. Mini Maker Faire, when you say that, it sounds to me like you should be wearing some sort of monocle and stroking a cat. Okay, we'll let Gbert bask in that image for a while. While we go over to our other co-host, Mr. Curtis Franklin, the executive editor of Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, so good to see you. I guess it's nice and sunny in Florida?
Padre, it is a bright, sunny, beautiful day here in Florida, and it just got sunnier because now I have the image of Gbert in a monocle stroking a cat stuck in my head, so life is just about perfect.
Well, now that life is perfect with Mini-Me over there in Hawaii, why don't we get straight in to the Enterprise Byte? We've got something interesting here. It's not really a story. It was alluded to in something that was reported to on the Register about how IBM has bet big on big data, on data analytics. But over the course of the last year or so, I've been gathering a couple of stories that talk about how IBM has slowly been amassing an empire of big data and web services. And really, it's been a quiet amassing. Now, imagine this. Their big data and analytics efforts now encompasses over 15,000 people in the field, including 400 mathematicians. That's right, 400 employees whose only job it is to come up with the algorithms that sort through big data coming in through various sources. Now, imagine this. Take a look at some of the acquisitions that they made in 2013. IBM invested $7 billion to bolster its cloud services by making 15 specific acquisitions to get companies that deal with big data and cloud services. That includes Star Analytics on January 13th, a company that specialized in extracting data from financial portfolios. In February of 2013, they acquired Stored IQ, which specialized in the analysis and management of distributed email, file sharing, desktop, and collaboration sites. In April of 2013, they acquired Urban Code, which is a company that specialized in the automation of software, especially software for mobile, social, big data, and cloud applications. In June of 2013, they acquired SoftLayer, the world's largest privately held cloud computing infrastructure provider. In September of 2013, Deja Image Systems, which specialized in software that can view large documents and images. In December of 2013, they acquired FiberLink Communications, which specialized in mobile management and security. And in late December 13, they acquired Aspera, which specialized in secure movement of massive data files around the world. In fact, Aspera has the ability to reduce transmission times for large files by up to 99.9%. Now, I want to throw this over to you, Brian. When you hear about a company, especially a company that's been, let's be honest, kind of moribund like IBM, making all these acquisitions that seem to be pointing in a specific direction, what does your journalistic nose tell you?
Well, what this is actually telling me is that IBM is finally decided to jump into a market segment, and they plan on owning it. I mean, owning it in a huge, huge way. When you start reading through all these different acquisitions, what you're looking at really is the ability to create a standardization within the big data industry. I would not be surprised if IBM starts very quietly testing a new set of APIs so that you can more standardize the big data segments. So I'm looking forward to seeing what IBM does when they become public on this.
Right, right. What about you, Curtis? It seems to me that, IBM has bet the farm on this. They're not really doing anything else in hardware or services other than cloud and now data analytics. In fact, we're both going to be at a conference in just a week, Enterprise Connect in Orlando, Florida, where IBM will be there touting their new data analytics service, the ability to look at social media and beyond. Emails and any other streams of information that could tell you about the sentiments online about your company. Is IBM playing in a crowded field? Because it seems to me there's a lot of companies that are trying to do this.
Well, there are a lot of companies that are trying to do this, but it really breaks down at this point into a very small handful of big enterprise-serving companies that are trying to do this and a whole bunch of startups. To be honest, I think that IBM getting into it to this scale puts them in the company of about two or three others. If you look at SAP, they have gone, of course, all into analytics for some time. When you look at a company like SAS, they are really big in this. And they're a company that flies below the radar a lot. But the SAS Institute, consistently voted one of the best companies to work for in the country, also makes the kind of analysis software that this goes in. What IBM has, though, is the ability to put together a soup to nuts vision from the hardware that people will want on their own systems to host this, all the way through the big cloud services and the analytics software. I think that IBM is using the same sort of enterprise intelligence that 20 years ago told them it was time to get out of hardware and go into services. Now they're using that same culture to say analytics, big data is the place to be. And to me, that's a very huge and very important bet.
I like that. Now, I want to throw this over to you, T-Bert, because I think Curtis mentioned something very important, which is a decade ago, IBM made a conscious decision to leave the hardware market. We know that when they sold that division off to Lenovo. Now, you can debate whether or not that was a good idea, but we know that the hardware market, especially that particular market, desktops and laptops, are operating on razor-thin margins, and now it seems that IBM is moving into the services industry. They really want to be the provider for the next generation of analytics for enterprise, for big business, even maybe small business. Now, let's see what they've got. With these acquisitions, IBM now owns, as Curtis said, the soup to nuts. They can extract data from large disparate data sets. They can collect data from multiple devices across the internet securely. They can transfer and analyze data with the world's largest cloud computing infrastructure. They can securely push analysis to multiple clients. And they can do everything more quickly than everyone else because they own those algorithms that can compress up to 99.9% whenever you're dealing with a big data set. That gives IBM something that I've never heard of any other company, including EMC and Oracle, who are all trying to get into this big data business, a competitive advantage, right?
Well, you got to keep in mind what the pedigree of IBM really means. IBM literally helped. Well, they literally built the PC industry. They literally built the mainframe industry. They have the potential. They've got the knowledge. They've got the scientists. They've got the background. And most importantly, they've got the cash. What I'm seeing in all these acquisitions is not only is this going to be resulting in, you know, very big changes in how big data is used, I think what we're going to see is we're going to start seeing big data getting pushed down into the smaller and smaller corporations. It's one of those things that could be as big a change in the way we do things as the browser was. And big data has the possibility of bringing about what we really and truly want to see in the cloud as far as a universal cloud. You don't have to worry about what the underlying platform is. You don't have to worry about languages. You just give it a problem and let it go. Big data has this direction. They have this leaning. And I think we're going to see some absolutely amazing things from IBM, especially since IBM doesn't jump until they know they can own the business.
All right. I like that. So IBM is slow and plodding, but they do know what they're doing. At least we hope they do. I want to do one more question before we move on to our guest, Curtis. And that is this. We've got people like Retro D in the chat room. We're saying, look, there are lots of IBM layoffs in Arizona. In fact, we've seen massive layoffs from IBM in the recent years. And this seems to be a very different direction to take big data. When we've spoken about big data in the past, it has mostly been either on the scientific side or it has been from companies like Facebook and Google, which have access to just huge data sets from users, for consumers. This is a different kind of data analysis. It's not data analysis of publicly available data. It's data analysis of data that is proprietary to certain corporations, which I think makes it far more attractive to the enterprise. So my question to you is this. Is this setting up a showdown between public big data, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Yahoos, and private big data, the enterprises and the financial institutions who actually can pull from large, disparate, but private and proprietary data sets?
Well, there are a handful of companies that would love to make this exactly that sort of battle. And I think Google is the main one. Google would love for its products to be used not just for dealing with publicly available information, but for the enterprises to go ahead, use those products for their proprietary information. They're only having so much success there for a lot of reasons. As you say, IBM has the track record. IBM has the contacts. IBM has the hardware on the hosted side. In many cases, IBM is, in fact, storing that private data already. And let's not forget that there are some real advantages. One of them is System Z, the current IBM mainframes. These are still the huge transactional engines inside most big enterprises. Yes, the farms of PC-based servers are out there doing a lot of work, but the mainframe is not dead. So if IBM can go into the mainframe data, do big data type work on those, it's a huge win for them and for their customers. And the other thing is that IBM has been doing this for a long time. You know, you mentioned the layoffs. IBM is moving people around, laying off people in the areas where they no longer want to make the huge investments. And as we're seeing, adding people here, they have the ability to do that. They have the resources to pay for it. And I think it's very exciting that they're actually investing in this as a company rather than simply putting out grants for universities to do the work. There are only so many companies that have the resources to do this scale of research in-house. To see one of them actually making the investment to go ahead and place the bet on big data says an awful lot.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I think either way we can agree that this is IBM's big bet. Now, when we come back, we're going to be bringing back a favorite to the show. That's Mr. Brandon Ross, who is our networking guru. We bring him in anytime we want to talk about routing protocols or just really the engine that drives the internet. And we've got a super special guest. You wanted to talk about IPv6? Well, we brought you the president of Aaron. That's right. He's going to tell us all about what it's like to steward the deployment of IPv6. But before then, let's take some time to thank one of the sponsors of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, when we talk about sponsors of the Twiat Riot, we're often talking about pure tech companies or service companies, which is why I love welcoming in, well, I'm going to call them an outlier, but now they're really a member of the family, Prosper. Now, let me ask you this question. If you knew that in 72 hours you could have $35,000 to cover your needs, what would you do with it? I mean, would you pay off your high-rate credit cards? Would you start a business? Would you finally do that home improvement project that you've been putting off all these years? Well, what if I told you that by filling out an easy online application and providing a few details, you could see a rate online? instantly, without ever stepping foot in a bank. Well, that's not a fantasy, that's Prosper. Prosper is an innovative peer-to-peer lending process, Silicon Valley's answer to the more modern community-based personal loans. There are no outrageous fees, no raising interest, and yes, you'll never set foot in a bank. Now, I remember back in the day when my computer consultation company started expanding past the point at which my resources could support it, I needed cash, which meant that I needed a loan from a bank. And that process was, well, it was as demeaning as it was confusing. Showing one bank manager after another that my business wasn't just cash positive, but profit flush, with a need for just enough cash to fulfill my existing contracts. I wish Prosper had existed back then, that I could have saved myself the wear and tear of the bank shuffle and gotten the cash that I needed immediately. Prosper offers low fixed rates, unsecured personal loans, no collateral required, and has multi-year terms available. They have more than 2 million members and over 900 million in funded loans. Folks, this is a revolution in financing, something that you've only heard about as a trial program overseas or as a series of microloans. Prosper is connecting people who need money with those who have it to loan. It's really that simple. Just go to prosper.com/twit to check your rate instantly without affecting your credit score. So here's what we want you to do. For a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Go to prosper.com/twit for a special site just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and receive a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Prosper.com is not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit prosper.com/twit. And we thank Prosper for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. We welcome back to the show Mr. Brandon Ross, I believe. Hopefully his Skype is working. Thank you for coming back, Brandon. Oh, and you're muted. There you go.
That should be better.
Now we can hear you. Thank you for coming back to the show. It's always wonderful to have you.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, joining you is a man that you've worked with, but we're just only meeting now, Mr. John Curran, who is the president and CEO of ARIN, the American Registry for Internet Numbers. John, thank you so very much for visiting us.
Happy to be here.
Now, John, we really want to talk to you about this, because as the president and CEO of ARIN, is it undue to say that you are responsible for shepherding, for taking care of, for deploying IPv6 across North America and much of the Bahamas and the Atlantic Islands?
It seems like a setup of a question, but let's go with yes.
Okay. Good man.
The fact is, I am responsible for making sure that these numbers are available and that people know that we're in the middle of a transition.
Right. We are. We're absolutely in the middle of a transition. And in fact, Brandon Ross has come onto the show and been with Carl Auerbach talking all about the transition between IPv4 and IPv6. But before we get to that, why don't we give the folks at home a little overview of what ARIN is? I'm sure that most of them have heard about ARIN. They at least know that it exists, but they may not know what ARIN does or how it was created. Can you give us a little bit of a history lesson here?
Absolutely. So let me give you the very short summary. ARIN is one of the five regional internet registries, or RIRs. And a regional internet registry is, there's five of us, each one dedicated to one region of the globe. ARIN's region is Canada, United States, and about half of the Caribbean. The other half of the Caribbean and South America is in LACNIC. There's AFRINIC, RIPE, APNIC. So we're one of the five regional registries. We handle issuing IP addresses, IP version 4, IPv4, and IP version 6, IPv6. We also handle autonomous system numbers for those of you who happen to be router geeks and know what an AS number is. So we issue them to businesses, ISPs, so that they can connect customers up to the internet. Most people deal with us through something known as WHOIS. When you have an IP address connecting to your web server or your mail server and you want to know who is that person, you go to the WHOIS and you look it up. That data is probably coming from ARIN, because WHOIS is the registry of all the address blocks that have been issued. So that's the high-level summary.
Got it. Now, one of the things that I've heard coming from ARIN often, every time I go to these conferences, I hear about asking us to become good internet citizens, to be responsible internet citizens, being responsible network administrators. What does that mean? I mean, I understand that Aaron has a board that's elected by its members, but what is this citizenship of the internet? What is this good stewardship of the internet?
So the internet's a little unique because the fact is that the internet is not something that's architected from the top down. It is composed of all of the businesses, all of the little ISPs and large ISPs, hosting companies, cloud providers. Collectively, each one runs their own piece of the internet, and collectively, that is what we call the internet. There is no government internet. It's not as if it's architected from the top down. You can become an internet provider, get a set of IP addresses, connect to another ISP, get your routing set up, and now you're off and running. That's very different than, say, standard telephony services, where to be a phone provider, you need to get a regulated entity, you need to file applications at the state and the federal level. So the good news is the internet's innovative, and you can become an ISP and you can very rapidly grow the internet. What comes with that flexibility is the need for all of us to be good citizens and understand that your internet service is connected to everyone else's and that you're responsible for it. You need to make sure that you have your entries and who is correct. You need to make sure that if you're using your addresses, you've updated them. If you allocate addresses to customers, you've put the entries in for the customers. Who knows? Those customers may spam one day, and you don't want that pointing back to your ISP. You want it pointed back to the customer who's causing the problem. So it's maintaining good hygiene with your network addresses.
I like that. Good hygiene. Good network hygiene. Now, let me get another view on that same question from you, Brandon. You are not part of Aaron, right? I mean, you're not sitting on the board or an executive member of Aaron. Let me make sure that I'm right about that, correct?
No, you're right. You're right. I did run for a position on the advisory council, but that was over a year ago and I didn't win.
Right. Well, thank God you didn't, because now we can have you as an impartial member of this group. Now, as a high level routing protocol specialist, you have to deal with Aaron. In fact, you are the one who most closely deals with their decisions and with their call for network citizenship. So how does the Aaron, I'm going to call it propaganda, but I don't mean that in the bad sense. How does the Aaron propaganda affect you? How does it change the way that you administer your networks?
Well, I mean, honestly, you know, it depends on exactly which part of administering a network and address policy we want to talk about. Certainly, we manage IPv4 addresses very differently than we manage IPv6 addresses, and that's mainly because of the relative scarcity of IPv4 versus IPv6. So being a good citizen with IPv4 addresses might mean not wasting them, not using them in frivolous manners, and instead, you know, making sure that you use just what you need. While with IPv6, we might take a very different approach to good citizenship. With IPv6, we may want to optimize for maintainability and human readability than we might for conservation of the address space since it's so large.
Right. What about this? When you are doing the things that you need to do to, say, connect the interop net to the network, and you're having to advertise IPv4 routes, how involved do you have to get with Aaron? Or does Aaron just give you your bulk addresses and say, these are the ones that belong to you, these are the ones that you can advertise? I mean, what I'm trying to get at is for the budding administrator here, how much should they be concerned about what Aaron's policies are on IPv4 and IPv6?
Well, it depends on the organization's growth rate. So Interop is probably a bad example. Interop was around long before actually Aaron even existed and got a very large block of address space early on in the development of the internet. So Interop itself doesn't really have to interact with Aaron very much. We might update our whois information every once in a while as our address changes or phone number changes. But for a more typical organization that tends to grow over time and that has started in the last 20 years as opposed to the last 30 years, they probably have a lot fewer IPv4 addresses. And if they're growing, they're going to need more over time. So if you need more over time, that means that you do have to interact with Aaron in order to go and request additional address space. And that would be the primary place that viewers of this show would be interacting with Aaron.
John, I want to go back over to you because we just quickly touched on the exhaustion of IPv4 address space. Could you give us a quick history of what happened? I remember that there was that point that we were coming to for 20, 30 years where we were saying we're running out of IPv4 address space. And there were all these requests for how do we best solve this? How do we best make sure that we future-proof the internet, future-proof our networks? How did this come about? Who raised the flag first? And then how did we decide to solve it?
So it's probably a little ancient history at this point, but the internet was running on IPv4 since the beginning. We're talking about in the late 70s, the internet protocol is what was used to connect the ARPANET, the MILNET, CSNET, and then the National Science Foundation Network, which was the precursor to the internet backbone. As commercial networks emerged along with the NSFNet and interconnected and did peering amongst them, in the early 90s, we noticed that the internet was really taking off. In fact, there were forecasts in 1993 and 94 of how successful the internet was. And we realized that just based on the earliest years and the growth rates, the internet was going to run out of IPv4 addresses around 2010 to 2017. This is based on the geometric growth curves and fits that we had done over various time periods. So it was actually back in the early 90s that the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, that does internet protocols like IPv4, like your mail protocol, SMTP, your BGP routing protocol, the IETF said, we need a new internet protocol. Created a working group called the IP Next Generation Working Group, or IPNG, which came up with, it looked at six or seven different proposals, weeded them down to two or three, had a bake-off, and in the end chose one of those proposals and anointed it IP version 6, the new internet protocol with 128-bit addresses. So that was the main force, the long-term initiative to fix the growth rate of the internet to make sure that when we ran out of IPv4, we had more options. The second thing we did at the same time was we were giving out address blocks in three sizes, what you call classes, class A, class B, and class C. And those classes were based on fixed boundaries. And we actually had to change the routing protocols and notation. And we introduced something called CIDR, C-I-D-R, classless interdomain routing, which allowed us, instead of having to issue you 256 addresses or issue you 65,000 or 16 million, which were the size choices we had before, it allowed us to issue on any bit boundary. So we could issue an organization 256 addresses, but if they needed 400, we could issue them 512 and not have to go to 65,000. So the combination of issuing addresses on a better boundary condition instead of 8-bit boundaries, 1-bit boundary, gave us more time. And then we use that to perfect IPv6. And IPv6 has actually been available in production now for some 14 years. So it's at the point now where lots of organizations have just turned it on and use it. You might not even realize you're using it in some cases in your mobile phone or in your home router when you're going to sites like Facebook and Google.
Right. Like I know, for example, that there are several carriers that right now every mobile phone, every smartphone has an IPv6 address. They're no longer using IPv4 on some carriers. I want to ask you something, Brandon, because, again, you're coming from the administrator side, the guy who actually has to put this into play. I remember when we were starting to talk about IPv4 address exhaustion and the need for IPv6, suddenly there was a popularity of NAT device, the network address translation, which allowed us to take a single IPv4 address and turn it into basically an unlimited number of unroutable IPv4 addresses. Would you say that the rise of NAT slowed the adoption of IPv6?
Oh, that's a tough question. The rise of NAT certainly enabled people to delay having to deal with IPv6 at the time. So I guess from that perspective, yes, I think it probably did a little bit. But I think IPv6 has been slow to deploy in some ways for some other reasons too. And that's mostly just due to so much momentum being out there for IPv4.
Yeah, I like it. Okay. Now, John, let me go back to you to ask you this question. This is something that I think a lot of people in the chat room are going to point out anytime we have a discussion about IPv4/IPv6. And that is, when we talk about good internet citizenship, we talk about some of these entities who received huge blocks, as you mentioned, in the old days, getting a Class A, Class B, Class C, just in mass, now returning some of those addresses because they know that they don't need them. A good example is Interop. Interop had a Class A. They had several Class Bs and a dozen Class Cs. And we realized we really don't need that. And so they returned the Class A and a lot of Class Bs in exchange for some from IPv6 space. But there are other incredibly large holders of IPv4 space. You could just look it up and figure out who owns them, who are still sitting on these huge caches of IPv4 addresses that don't get used. Is that something that Aaron is pushing for? Are you still saying, look, we need those back from you if you're not using them? Or are you just saying, look, go ahead and sit on them because we're all moving to IPv6?
So I probably the best thing to think about is this is not a new situation. In fact, the ability that we've had to have IPv4 addresses available for as long as we have is because of good citizenship on behalf of Interop, but also a long chain of organizations before them, including Stanford University, BBN, Bolt, Burnick, and Newman, who was my alma mater, worked on the ARPANET and MILNET, including the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, all of whom had address blocks, all of whom, when they didn't need them, turned them in. So first and foremost, we have decades of history of organizations who did not need the address space turning them in, and that's been helpful. It's let us get to where we are today. We literally would have run out years ago if that was not the case. So that is certainly a valid option. We even to this day occasionally have someone turning in address space because they don't need it. But the other thing we realized is that it is possible that parties that have address space and are only using a quarter of it. You got a block of 65,000, you have a small university, you're using 8,000 IP addresses. You don't need more than 50,000 of them. They're unused. But because of the person before you who allocated their address map based on buildings or street numbers, your address usage is spread throughout the entire block. Now, even if you want to be a good citizen and give up the addresses you don't use, there's a lot of work involved. These addresses do not renumber themselves. And you have configuration, tables, addresses. We all know in a network the number of places IP addresses show up. The community, and this is not Aaron's staff. Again, Aaron policy is developed by the group that Aaron, that Brendan referenced, the Aaron Address Council, elected from the community, came up with something called a transfer policy that allows someone who has addresses that aren't using them to transfer them to someone who wants them. And yeah, there could be a fee involved. Aaron's not involved in that fee. That's between the two parties, but we update the registry. So the fact is now we also have a market incentive for those parties that have the address blocks that they're not using, that they are sitting on. Maybe it's going to take them 10 people working for 6 months to get off half of their address block. This way they can get compensated by someone who needs addresses. So if you go to the Aaron website, you'll see transfer information. It asks, you've got IP addresses? Do you need IP addresses? Click here for more information. Even when Aaron runs out, you'll be able to go to the transfer market to get address space, at least for a small amount of time.
Oh, Brandon, again, I want to throw this back to you because you are the administrator on the ground, on the streets, the guy who actually has to implement this. And this will be the last question I ask before we go into the next break. And that is, we know what we should do as good internet citizens, and John has alluded to that. But there's also that market. There's that market that really shouldn't exist, right? I mean, we're not supposed to be selling addresses to one another, and yet we still do. So my question to you is, it should that market disappear? We've got Retro D in the classroom, in the chat room, who's saying IPv6 keeps unused IPv4 address space from becoming a commodity. But both of us know that it has become a commodity, right? Are we expecting that to die out anytime soon?
Well, certainly not anytime soon, but I think an open and free market is the right way to solve the problem. I think exactly the way John described, by allowing one company to pay another company, you know, you can look at it as paying their costs to give up the address space, is healthy and the right thing to do, because it balances the amount of effort required to free up the addresses against somebody else's need for them. And I'm excited from another point of view, too, which is that the more expensive IPv4 gets, and of course, the cheapest address space will come on the market first and the more expensive later, the more it encourages organizations, especially enterprises, to look at alternatives to buying IPv4 space, or at least paying for a directed transfer of IPv4 space, to say it the right way. And so I'm excited about that, because it gives enterprise organizations a chance to go and sit down and really look at IPv6 in an objective way and throw the fear out and throw the uncertainty and doubt out the door and say, it's going to cost me X dollars to do this network expansion I'm talking about. It's going to cost me Y dollars to deploy IPv6 throughout my environment. Where does those two lines cross so that I can make the right decision? So I'm excited about that. Firms like myself are in a position to help organizations like that do those things. So, of course, I have a little bit of bias there, but I think it's the right thing to do, and I think it's going to help IPv6 adoption.
Brandon, John, thank you very much. Now, when we come back, we're going to bring the whole crew in for a little IPv6 love fest. But before that, why don't we take some time to talk about the next host, the next sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's the love of the Twilight Riot, RingCentral. When we built this studio, Leo decided that we needed to dog food. We had been telling our audience to put everything in the cloud, so why wouldn't we do the same? That's why our scheduling, our calendar is in the cloud. Our file sharing is in the cloud. Our email is in the cloud. We put everything possible in the cloud so that we can show people that really this is the new generation. So when our IT guy, Russell, came to us and told us that we could have a full-featured PBX in the cloud without any bulky equipment down in the basement, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. And now RingCentral has launched Meetings. So in addition to all that we love about RingCentral, receiving voicemails through email, sending and receiving fax messages from our smartphones, the auto receptionist who greets our callers and announces employees and department extensions, now with Meetings, we can host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Meetings makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the market today. Now, here's what we would like for you to do. If you're a member of the Twilight Riot, if you want to see if you could get the same sort of efficiencies out of what we get here at Twit TV, try RingCentral today. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it. We're having a fantastic discussion about IPv6. John, I want to go back to you really quickly. One of the things that we talk about is deployment rates. And we have this wonderful little Google map, Google statistic page that was sent to us by Will Dean, who is also a member of the Twilight Riot, who talked about the outside of private networks, IPv6 adoption seems to be lagging. Now, what this chart is showing us is how many people are using IPv6 when they go to Google services page. So that's Google search. That's all the Google apps. That's basically anything attached to YouTube or AdSense. Now, 3.15% of connections are native IPv6. 0.02% of connections use a 6-to-4 tunnel. This is sharply up from the adoption at the end of 2012, where it was about 0.75, but it still seems to be not all that great. Also, outside of North America and parts of Europe, we're not seeing a whole lot of IPv6. In fact, there are parts of the world where IPv6 will not be routed, period. So let me ask you, as the steward of IPv6 here in Erin, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Is this what you were hoping for? Is this right on track? Or do we need to do more to push the adoption of IPv6?
So if you think about IPv6, you've got a challenging situation because it solves the problem of an internet service provider who runs out of IPv4 addresses and needs to connect new customers. But it only solves that problem when we have content that's available over both IPv4 and IPv6. The vast majority of the websites are only reachable via IPv4 today. So a service provider can't hook up a customer with just IPv6 addresses and rely on the fact that they can get to the entire internet. In fact, folks like the mobile phone operators and the cable companies who are using V6 to connect up new customers have to use a gateway to get them to old IPv4 content. If you could use just V6 and get to the entire internet, then you would see a huge growth curve because basically almost every new customer connection would be using IPv6. Because we can't give that today, because IPv6 can only get to websites that are reachable with IPv6, you're seeing a much more modest growth rate. And that's what you're looking at with that curve. Even then, that curve's pretty remarkable. Now, it looks very impressive, but you'll see the top of the curve is 3%. But if you look at the last 2 years, we've basically gone from 0.5% to 3%. And it's increasing. The growth of users being connected fresh with IPv6 is going up pretty rapidly. It could take 5 or 10 years. Even that would be a remarkable success. The thing that we're hoping is that as more content comes on the network with IPv6, that will help drive more users to be able to be turned on that way, because it will become more cost effective for a network operator to use IPv6 to connect up their internet customers.
Very, very good point. Let me throw that over to Curtis Franklin. Curtis, again, speaking from the enterprise, the executive enterprise side, do you think there is a lot of understanding among the executive community in the enterprise that if they don't provide services in IPv6, they may be missing out on an entire audience that only can reach those things in IPv6. Is this discussed at all, or do they just assume that IPv6 to IPv4, IPv4 to 6 and 6 to 4 tunnels will work forever and ever?
I think if you get to the executive suite outside of IT, then their eyes glaze over once you get to IPv, and after that, it's just gibberish to them. Even within the IT community, I think that there is a basic understanding of the principles behind IPv6 and the reasons it's important. But there's a lot of people who say, you know, the IPv4 to IPv6 tunnels are working beautifully well, and we don't see any reason to invest heavily in changing our infrastructure until we're absolutely forced to do so. So I think it's going to take customers coming to them and saying, you know, we would love to buy stuff at your new website. We would love to be able to get to your new service, whatever it is, but we simply can't. And our provider tells us it's because of an addressing mismatch. When they start hearing that, then they'll take action. Until then, they kind of trust the network geeks to keep them out of trouble and are grateful that they feel that they don't really have to understand the issue any more deeply than that.
Retro D in the chat room says that you've nailed it. It's too complex to sell to the money people. Let me throw that over to Chibert. Brian, you actually do administration for the network over at the University of Hawaii. Is this something that you have to worry about? I mean, I know that you've been playing with Internet 2 for the longest time. Do you have any concerns about IPv4, IPv6, and the translation between the two? Or do you see this as just something that's going to be organically solved as we run out of IPv4 addresses to give?
It's actually a really hard question to answer. One of the things I'm seeing is there's been a fairly slow adoption of V6 into the appliance world. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, big switches. I'm talking about things like print servers or NASs and so forth. It's this slow adoption that's causing a lot of the slowness to happen. Well, why should I move to V6 if I can't even print to my print servers? And I do scans of my network every once in a while to find out how many really, really ancient jet directs I have they're still 10 meg half duplex, and it's still staggering how many there are out there. So that's one thing that has to change. It needs to become easier. The appliances need to have more V6 adoption. They're getting there, but there's still a lot of legacy things out there that still only talk V4. I think the other issue is, right now at the University of Hawaii, if you want to run V6, you're running a dual stack. So my Mac is actually running V4 and V6 simultaneously. So if I go to resources like Google or YouTube or whatever that have native V6, I'll go via V6. If I can't get to it on V6, it drops automatically to V4. This intermediate step seems to be where I see a lot of the V6 adoption going. Now, what I'd love to see is more people like Penn State. Penn State will broadcast their home games, but only over V6. So if they're want to go and see something at Penn State, you want to see it live, you got to watch it on V6. I think we need more carrots like this.
I like it. Let me go over to you, Brandon, again, being my personal network guru. Have you deployed a network recently that wasn't at least dual stack? Let me just start with that.
No. Every project that Network Utility Force does includes IPv6 as part of our deployment. Everyone. We feel it's the right thing to do. But I have some comments for you.
Go for it.
Yeah. So to fill in a little bit around what Curtis and Brian said, I think the way to describe this to executives is becoming more and more clear. If you go to an executive and you say, let's assume you're an enterprise that sells something on your website, whether it's a service or a product, doesn't really matter. But we all know that customers are very fickle. They're going to order their products from a website that's fastest. If Amazon is faster than your website, your orders are going to Amazon. And everyone in the retail business knows this, even some of the wholesale business. So now I want all of you who are now listening to go to www.nanog.org, the North American Network Operators Group website. I want you to look up a talk that was given by Lee Howard. It's called IPv6 Performance Bonus on Nanog 60 Tuesday, February the 11th, and watch it. Because what Lee has found and some other folks that spoke with him is that you actually get a reasonable performance improvement by sending traffic over IPv6. And that's even before we've added all these NATs and other garbage into our network that's even going to slow things down even more for IPv4. So if you're selling something on a website, you have got to do V6, or the guy down the street who's doing it is going to take your business.
Okay. And actually, that might be a really good way to explain to the money heads, which is, hey, guess what? Do this or you're going to lose business. That might be the simplest thing to say to an executive. Let me go back to you, John, because I think there is a good question here, which is because Brian Chi and Brandon are both dual stacking everything. I mean, every new piece of gear is going to include native IPv6 support. Is that a win for Aaron? Can Aaron now say, hey, we declared victory. As long as you've got dual stack, it means you're future proof, and IPv4 will just naturally go away as people realize it's no longer the primary protocol for talking to one another.
Let me answer that, but I want to also touch on the prior question a bit. Recognize that the entire internet does not have to go V6. The public internet is going V6. You may have a printer in your office that you're going to access with IPv4. You may have servers somewhere that you're going to access with V4. It's not necessary that your LAN, your corporate or enterprise network has to do V6. You might want to. There's good reasons to. But the most important thing is the public internet most certainly has to go to V6. To answer someone who's spending money, I can actually make it very simple. Imagine spending $100,000 on a website to sell products or to stream training or educational broadcasts, and then someone telling you, well, you spent all that money, but you only put it on part of the internet. You only put it on the IPv4 portion. And in fact, the irony of this is that when someone accesses it from, for example, a mobile phone using IPv6, all of your IPv4 content gets mapped through these gateways to get to that phone, to get to increasingly as more things are V6 based. Someone who spent a lot of money to try to get their content and service on the entire internet went all the way to the end, but then forgot to connect it up to both protocols and only did V4 is is selling short their project and is going to suffer performance when it gets mapped to a V6-only device like a mobile phone, isn't going to be able to get web metrics. So where's that phone coming from? Well, for some reason, all those phones are coming from Northern Virginia and San Jose. I don't see them like I do with V4 throughout the country because they're being gatewayed from V6 to V4 in those two locations. So if you actually talk to someone who develops and puts public-facing websites, if your public-facing website isn't connected with V6, you're shortchanging your entire project. You're literally going through a lot of effort but not doing the easiest step of connecting up to V6 at the end. And that will hurt you, and your customers, as Brandon said, will go elsewhere.
Well, gentlemen, we are going to come right back. We're going to finish off our discussion of IPv6. But before that, let's take time to talk about the last sponsor of the Twit, right? And, of course, that's TechSERP. Now, you know that Apple is in the enterprise. We all know that. We've seen that, especially in the BYOD era. Apple is an integral part of the enterprise, but we don't talk about them all that much on This Week in Enterprise Tech, which is why I'm so happy to have TechSERP be part of the Twit Riot. Now, we're seeing some amazing technology solutions deployed on iPads these days. Businesses keep coming up with creative ways to service their customers, increasing productivity among employees, and make more money with the same resources all by using the iPad. For example, the Institute of Culinary Education equips students, faculty, and chefs with the iPad, empowering them to do away with heavy and unwieldy textbooks and streamlining the learning process. A major cable service provider in the Northeast gave its field technicians, who are the public face of the company, iPads that had been configured to provide better service to customers. And retail companies have enhanced their in-store customer experience by using the iPad, not just as a point-of-sale device, but also as a spot where customers can learn about sales, special offers, and upcoming events. These clients and more all turned to TechSERP, the country's largest Apple reseller that sells, supports, and manages the largest iPad deployments in the world to manage their iPad projects. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with an experienced partner? TechSERP assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple solutions, as well as solutions from Avid, Adobe, and more throughout the United States. No matter if you've started deploying iPads already or are just getting started, TechSERP can help. Now, right now, TechSERP offers a complimentary download just for the Twit listeners who are deploying iPads or who are interested in learning more about doing so. You can go to techserp.com/twit-7sins to get access to the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment and see the common pitfalls that throw companies for a loop during their iPad projects. What we want you to do is we want you to go ahead and get this complimentary download. See if maybe iPads might be the next step for success of your business model. The complimentary download is available right now just for my listeners at techserve.com/twit-7sins. And we thank TechSERP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's finish it up. I want to go back to you, John. If we start looking at IPv6 as something that companies are just going to naturally go to, I think the natural question that comes to me is, how do you see Aaron in the future? Is Aaron going to be a regulator? Is Aaron a registry? How does Aaron enforce good stewardship of IPv4/IPv6 space?
That's actually the easiest question. Because Aaron's job is to simply coordinate a unique registry. So that's just like filling a table in an Excel, one line, one entry. And we do that with the other 5 regional registries. Whether we're talking about the table of all the IPv4 addresses or the table with all the IPv6 addresses, there'll be a role for having a registry to keep track of which organizations are using which numbers. And because all of the internet service providers and hosting companies, cloud providers, all participate in and need a registry so they can safely connect with a unique address to the internet, there'll always be a role for a unique registry of internet numbers. And it we'll have V4, we'll have V4 and V6. 50 years from now, we may just have V6. V4 may be in the same state as SNA, DECnet, and IPX. We don't know. But there'll always be a public registry because you need to have a public directory to be able to figure out where the traffic is coming from.
Got it. Let's go one last time around the horn. Let's start with you, Curtis. So again, hoping that you can give us the enterprise view of Aaron. Is this something that's even on the radar of executives? We've talked a lot about how you would tell an executive that they need to have support. They need to provide the resources to have the support for IPv6. Do they understand what Aaron does? Do they need to know what Aaron does? Or is this something that an executive just needs to know, well, this is the way that you stay connected? Well, what's your take on that?
I honestly think that for most executives, their knowledge of Aaron should be pretty cursory. This is something that really is at a level of detail that is beyond the average executive, and that's okay. It is the job of network admins, network architects, network executives to make sure that the other enterprise executives don't have to worry about this. I mean, let's face it, in most companies, if an executive is introduced to the minutiae of the network, it means that something has gone horribly, horribly wrong. The big thing that I'll say about this, to the extent that they are aware of it at all, I'll agree with Chebert. The very long rollout has hurt the awareness. This is something that is in most people's minds now, like Y2K. It's something they heard about a number of years ago when they heard, hey, this is a big problem, and if we don't deal with it right now, the world is going to come to an end. Well, they kind of pushed that off. The world didn't come to an end, so they feel that it's either been dealt with or it was never a big problem to begin with. It's only the folks down at the network admin level, the network architect level, who know what's going on and who allow the rest of the executives to continue to live in blissful ignorance.
Chebert, what about you? Do you think that this is much ado about nothing? I mean, we've been talking about IPv6 literally for multiple decades here. Is this a problem that we're going to have to deal with, or is this something that's naturally going to solve itself?
No, I think it's something that needs to be. We can't ignore it. This is one of those things where if we don't start planning for it and to actually do something about it, it's not something you can do overnight. Well, yeah, you can. You can do it overnight, but it might hurt. So my suggestion actually is if you're a developer, if you produce a network attached device, you are actually doing the world a disservice if you don't turn on V6. I'm still finding a lot of, you know, various types of network attached devices that still don't have V6. That I think that's shouldn't happen anymore. I think the manufacturing sector, the people that are making the tools for the internet, need to support V6 because the end users don't feel like they're empowered to push it. You know, oh, I can't do V6 because such and such device doesn't work. I think when that excuse goes away, we might start seeing more adoption.
Brandon, over to you. We've got Big Ginge in the chat room who says, look, the reason why the world didn't end or the internet didn't end is because people have worked their butts off. People like you and Brian who actually get in there and address equipment. So is this, in your eyes, is this something that's going to require diligence on the part of the network administrators? I mean, you deal with network administrators all the time. Is there any people out there who still don't think they need to enable IPv6?
Oh, I think there's unfortunately a lot of people out there that think they don't need to. But I think when they say they don't need to, I think a lot of that's grown from fear rather than from actual practical concerns. So like John said, you don't have to be all or nothing with IPv6. It's not this big monolithic problem where if you don't deploy V6 on every single device that you own in your entire enterprise that you're out of luck. It's simply not the case. I could go and enable just about any company's website for IPv6 in literally under an hour. And that's by using some tricks with load balancers and whatnot that can do the translation as long as their upstream service provider had IPv6. And that's a huge part of it right there. We keep talking about how the content is really the biggest problem, right? Because the service providers are pretty much coming along at deploying V6. You know, a large portion of Comcast, for example, already has IPv6, as with many of the other residential service providers. So if I can go and enable someone's website in a few hours for IPv6, that gets us a long way of the way there. And I just think that the cost is so low to do that, that as soon as, you know, more executives see a little bit of this, you're going to see a lot more adoption. And those excuses about, well, this device or that device doesn't support it, really pretty much melt away, because it's not important for every last device to support it.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we've come to the end of our time. Our audience has used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 99% of IPv6 routers. Now, I do want to thank our panelists all for coming on and talking about this very important issue for network geeks, for IT people. IPv6 really is the future. I mean, I know it's a cliche, but when we look forward, it's really the only technology that's going to allow us to keep growing our networks like we expect to. I do want to give my panel a chance to get their plugs in. Let's start with you, T-Bert. I know you've got Minimaker Fair coming up, so maybe you can convince people to jump in that last-minute plane ticket over to Honolulu.
Well, we've got about 500 people signed up, so I'm pretty happy, and lots of vendors. But I do want to have one last kind of plug at this. A lot of universities are already doing a lot of V6, and a lot of websites are already enabled, but I'd like to go and start making that next step. Universities have always been kind of the melting pot for trying out new stuff. We are starting to make noise about trying to move to an entirely V6 environment. And so far, there's just a few too many stumbling blocks to really make that successful.
Fantastic. Thank you, T-Bert. Thank you again. It's always a pleasure to see you. What about you, Curtis? I know that both of us are going to be at Enterprise Connect, but is there anything else that you think the enterprise efficiency crowd needs to know about?
Well, Padre, the big thing that I'd like to remind everybody of is that past Enterprise Connect, it's not very long until we'll be at Interop. And to get ready for Interop, we've been running a series of radio shows where we've been bringing in the speakers from Interop as well as some of the key people from the Interop net to do E2 Radio. Those are on our site. If someone is thinking about going to Interop and looking to hear sort of a taste of what they'll be missing if they don't go, I urge them to head over to Enterprise Efficiency, go to the radio archives. Everything that's for Interop is marked with Interop Preview. Give a listen. I think you'll be convinced that you really ought to be buying a plane ticket for Las Vegas.
Brandon Ross, another man who I will see at Interop, along with Brian Chi and Curtis Franklin. It's, again, always a pleasure. It's wonderful to have your insight. Can you tell people about who you are, your Network Utility Force company, the consultation that you do, and how they find you on the IPv6 interwebs?
Absolutely. You can visit us at www.netuf.net, N-E-T-U-F.net. And as a matter of fact, we have a brand new IPv6 infographic that shows you in a pretty graphical format the growth rate of IPv6 and another problem that we're predicting, which is the impending shortage of knowledgeable engineers with IPv6. So check out our website. The infographic is up there. Like you said, of course, I'll be at Interop, but I also wanted to make another plug for you, which is that I'll be moderating a panel, not on IPv6 this time, but on 100 gig Ethernet at CompTel exactly 1 week from today. That's right. I get to visit Vegas before you get there, Padre. It'll be at 9:15 a.m. at, I believe the event is at the Aria Hotel and Casino. And then I'll be hanging out for the entire show at the Walker & Associates booth. They're a good partner of ours. It's booth 417. So hope to see you there.
Hope to see you indeed. And thank you, thank you, thank you so very much, Mr. John Curran from Aaron. You're awesome. I really appreciate all the insight that you can bring in here. Could you please tell the folks where they can find you? Of course, they can find you at aaron.net.com, but where else should they expect to see you speaking?
I will be at Interop, of course, as well. And so you can find me. Aaron often has a booth. I actually don't recall if we have one at this one, but I am available at www.aaron.net. You can see the speaking schedule at www.teamaaron.net has all the places where Aaron has a booth or a speaking engagement. If you have a public website, make sure it's on the entire internet, and by making it IPv6 enabled, not just the legacy internet with IPv4.
Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you so very much. And I also want to thank you. That's right, our loyal audience, the people who download or watch us live each week. We couldn't have a show without you, and we thank you for getting the word out about This Week in Enterprise Tech. We love what we do. We love talking about the things that we talk about, and we love having awesome guests. And we can only do it because you keep watching the show. So we want to do something for you. We want to give you an easy way to get This Week in Enterprise Tech into your device of choice each and every single week automatically. That's right. If you go to our show notes page at twit.tv/twiet, you'll find a little menu where you can drop down and receive our feed into your iPad or your iPhone or your Android device of choice, your laptop, your desktop. No problem. It's one of those things that we do to make sure that you can consume the content the way you want to consume it. Also, please go ahead and subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/twiet. There you'll find not just all of our individual videos, but you'll be able to go through our back catalog of segments, all those pre-recorded pieces of content that show you how networking works. If you want to see stuff my IT guy says, pro tip, pro gear, all of those individual pieces of content we make available to you. Also, why not follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you do that, you'll be able to find out what I do in between episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. In fact, oh my goodness, I literally just hit 10,000 followers. I thank each and every single one of you. Also, you can find the chat room live. That's right, live, along with the show, because the show is here live every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. Go to live.twit.tv, and while you're there, jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Join the community, enjoy the trolls, and be part of the experience that is Twit TV. Finally, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, to Carson, my super producer, and to, well, that guy. Who's that guy behind the camera over there?
Oh, are you talking about that guy? That's Burke.
No. The other one. The tall one.
Oh, this one.
Yeah. Now, I heard, Jason, that you have a show on Twit TV that I'm going to totally blank on right now. I can't remember. It's something about iPhones, right?
I understand if you don't remember because you hate me for some reason. Whatever. It's called All About Android. And we really need to have you back on, Padre.
Oh, I know. We do because I'm all about Android.
Twit.tv/AAA. That's all you need to know.
Till then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep twiet.